Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepinchuk. On today's show, we'll feature a reading of an essay I wrote for the website flowtv.org entitled The Forthcoming DTV Tsunami, about the societal impacts of the conversion of U.S. television from analog to digital. We'll also present a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report. But now, a selection of news about media and democracy entitled Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
Federal Communications Commission Chairman Kevin Martin is paving the way for the agency to more closely regulate cable TV companies. New reports from industry and public interest groups show that cable companies have passed a benchmark set by Congress back in 1984 called the 70-70 threshold, which means 70% of homes have access to cable with 36 channels or more, and 70% of those households now subscribe to a cable service. Once the threshold has been reached, the FCC can issue regulations to promote greater diversity in programming. Harold Feld, Senior Vice President of Media Access Project, a nonprofit public interest media law firm, says consumer groups have been asking the FCC for the 70-70 finding for years.
When you get down to who's actually got the market power to control what people are seeing on their television screens, the 70-70 ruling is a recognition that that's cable, which really gets to call the shots on who gets on and who doesn't get on.
Many people are unhappy with what they're seeing on cable TV. Despite hundreds of channels, there are few choices when it comes to local or innovative and independent programming. Feld says that's because cable companies either place their own programming or make sweetheart deals with other cable companies, which keeps innovative programs off your screen.
When you're looking at the independents, people who might want to do different kinds of programming, they don't have that kind of leverage. And the cable operators have generally taken a hard line that says, either we own you, or you got something that we want, like broadcast programming, or we're not interested in dealing with you at all.
Martin is also circulating a separate order that would lower the price for independent programmers to lease cable access and make it easier for them to go to arbitration to resolve disputes.
Where the 70-70 is really important is, number one, in boosting the FCC's authority, being able to say, well, we're really going to put limits on the cable operator's ability to charge high rates to leased access programmers or to squeeze out independents in a way that goes beyond what the current statutory rules would say.
Feld says that the FCC could find that there are other steps necessary to promote diversity, like ensuring channels are set aside for public, educational, and local government access. The 70-70 finding is being challenged by the cable industry, which is not a surprise. The government has never tracked cable subscribers, and the accuracy of the numbers will probably be decided by a federal court.
By December 5th, the FCC must make a decision that will affect 34 million Americans. They will rule on Verizon's request to be released from regulations that allow smaller companies to lease the use of copper wiring that reach consumers' homes and businesses. If the request, called a forbearance petition, is granted, smaller telecom companies, often known for their lower prices, unique bundling of services, and innovative technologies, may be forced to raise their prices or may be shut out of the market altogether. The forbearance ruling would affect phone landlines, including DSL and other broadband services in six metropolitan areas on the East Coast: Boston, New York, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, Providence, and Virginia Beach. COVAD is a provider of broadband voice and data communications and is part of a group of telecom companies that are fighting the bill. Angela Simpson, COVAD's Director of Government Affairs, explains.
They don't want to provide competitors with certain parts of their network that they built when they were the monopoly phone provider. The very last mile between people's homes and the first point of contact with the broader telecom network. It makes no sense for competitors who dig up every yard, every street, to replicate the old copper wires.
The Telecommunications Act of 1996 required big phone companies to provide access to certain parts of their network at low rates to encourage competition. In exchange, the incumbent phone companies got the right to provide long-distance services in their regions. The intent of the forbearance provision, to allow phone giants to sidestep outdated regulations was good, Simpson says. But the phone companies have abused the loophole to get around provisions in the law that they don't like. Simpson says that test cases for this type of forbearance in Omaha and Anchorage have had a negative impact on competition. If the FCC grants the Verizon petition, consumers can expect more of the same in other parts of the country.
You can already see it happening again. Quest has asked for the same type of treatment in Denver, Seattle, Minneapolis, and Phoenix. So it is just sort of a matter of time. If this one gets granted, it's going to be sort of a domino effect.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
And now, a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report.
American foreign policy is the direct cause of the humanitarian crisis in Somalia, the worst in all of Africa, according to United Nations officials. That's why, until recent days, U.S. corporate media said little or nothing about the hundreds of thousands of Somalis, now numbering at least 500,000, who face death by starvation and disease because of a war instigated and facilitated by Washington. The corporate press methodically avoid, and thereby cover up, stories that contradict the mythical American narrative that the U.S. means to do good in the world and only does wrong by mistake. The horrific wrong inflicted on Somalia was absolutely premeditated, an integral aspect of American plans to bring the bogus war on terror to Africa as a cover to dominate the continent and its wealth. Ever since the end of formal European colonialism in Africa, U.S. policy has been to spread chaos wherever Washington failed to impose rule by its own favored strongmen. When Muslim groups early last year subdued the warlords of Somalia, a nation that is 99% Muslim, a semblance of peace and at least some hope for the future took root. By all accounts, life was getting back to something like normal for a people that had known only brutal warfare since 1991. Such a peace was unacceptable to George Bush's crew, who whipped up an hysteria in the United States, claiming Al-Qaeda was establishing a base in Somalia, and urged the regime in neighboring Ethiopia, Somalia's historical rival, to attack last December. The U.S. worked hand in hand with the Ethiopian invaders at every level of the Ethiopian military, while U.S. jets relentlessly wreaked terror from the air. Once the Ethiopians had planted themselves and their puppet Somali government in the capital, Mogadishu, the Americans sent their other African proxies, the Ugandan military, to make up most of the puny African peacekeeping force in Somalia. The Somali resistance to the Ethiopian invasion consider the African peacekeepers in Mogadishu to be agents of the U.S. And regarding the Ugandans, they are right. If there were ever a formula for bloody and protracted war in Somalia, it is Ethiopian occupation, which is already unifying diverse elements of the Somali population in resistance. The war will also destabilize Ethiopia, which is more than a third Muslim and home to many peoples that oppose the dictatorial regime in Addis Ababa. If the rulers of the United States were searching for a plan that would kill hundreds of thousands of Africans, they have found it. This time, however, as in Iraq, Washington has created more chaos than it can handle. The United Nations found it necessary to arrange trips for American journalists to witness the carnage that the Americans have wrought in Somalia. The same Americans that claim to care so much for the people of Darfur and who promise that the new U.S. Africa Command will bring peace to the continent. The Americans, like the Europeans before them, only bring the peace of the dead. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
The New World Resource Center presents We Are Many, Inquiries into Chicago Activism. It's a series of presentations highlighting the struggles and successes of Chicago-area activists and organizers looking to connect the political to the everyday. The series is held every second Thursday at 7 p.m. at 1300 Northwestern Avenue in Chicago. For more information, Visit myspace.com/NWRC for the New World Resource Center.
You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepinchik. We now feature a reading of an essay I wrote for the website flowtv.org entitled The Forthcoming DTV Tsunami, about the societal impacts of the conversion of television from analog to digital. The essay was published on the website flowtv.org on November 9, 2007. After the essay, I shared some impromptu commentary about the topic since the essay's publication. On Wednesday, February 18, 2009, all analog over-the-air TV broadcasting in the United States ceases and will be replaced with an all-digital broadcasting setup. The ostensible reason for this conversion to digital television, or DTV, is to improve television. With freed television spectrum resulting from the conversion, public safety communications can be increased and improved, more TV channels can be created, and picture quality can improve. But for current TV viewers, this means that if you use an antenna to get television, you will need a new TV set or some other digital television source like cable or satellite, or get a digital converter box, or your TV set goes dark permanently. The number of people potentially affected is considerable. Estimates say about 17% of Americans, roughly 51 million people, still get television through over-the-air analog signals. In Chicago, where I live, the number is about 21% of Chicago residents, according to a 2003 profile in the journal Media Week, roughly 630,000 people in a city of nearly 3 million people. It stands to reason that many of those who still use analog TV can't subscribe to a cable or satellite service simply because they are among the American poor or are on fixed or stagnating incomes, and understandably can't afford to subscribe. For that same reason, they probably can't afford to buy a new digital-ready TV set. The remaining option is to get a digital converter box, and indeed some efforts to help are crystallizing. Congress has allotted about $1 billion to provide vouchers for redeemable converter boxes. Each American household can claim up to two $40 vouchers to offset the costs for converter boxes, which can be purchased in retail stores. For the moment, it appears the vouchers will not cover the cost of converter boxes. Digital Streams, the manufacturer of the first government-approved converter boxes, has announced the suggested retail price of $69.99 per box. Granted, improved technology may over time lower the prices of converter boxes enough before DTV doomsday to improve the likelihood of converter box affordability. But many questions yet arise. What assurances are there that retailers won't take advantage of a guaranteed market and raise the price of converter boxes? Or, even if prices remain low, are retailers prepared for what could be a marked upsurge of millions of potentially desperate customers? The questions continue. Are people who need digital converter boxes prepared to deal with many folks in similarly dire straits, like taking time off from work to wait in massive lines? In the case of infirm or elderly individuals who can't leave their homes, or folks in rural communities not near any big-name retailers, or Americans who don't speak English, or people without any technical skills, what provisions are being made for them? In urban communities like Chicago, there have been serious examples of local public policy failures, like the infamous 1995 Chicago heat wave. As chronicled in Eric Kleinenberg's book Heat Wave, neglectful public policy decisions exacerbated that disaster, in which some 800 people died. For the DTV transition, it's unclear what local provisions are being set up, or how federal and local authorities would cooperate, or whether or not authorities at all levels can coordinate matters before DTV doomsday. The end result could be a lot of after-the-fact finger-pointing with little in the way to actually help people. All of this, of course, assumes that people learn about the conversion in time and can act with ample time. But levels of public awareness about the DTV transition are dismal. Surveys say that anywhere from 60% to 90% of Americans, depending on the survey, have no awareness of the DTV transition. The National Telecommunications and Information Administration has allotted $5 million for outreach efforts, a paltry sum compared, for example, to the hundreds of millions of dollars spent in Great Britain and in Germany for outreach efforts for their respective DTV conversion efforts, and with much smaller populations. The National Association of Broadcasters, the NAB, the main trade lobby of U.S. commercial broadcasters, has promised to devote some $700 million worth of broadcast airtime to public service announcements to inform Americans of the DTV transition. Magnanimous though this might sound, the NAB has simultaneously been fiercely resisting efforts in Congress to pass laws which would mandate specific educational requirements from TV broadcasters. But promises are one thing, policies are another. And considering that U.S. media companies garner some $70 billion annually from TV ads, this promised but as yet undelivered effort amounts to a one-time sacrifice of about 1% of commercial broadcasters' revenue. Nevertheless, the NAB has been losing the fight. Support is strong in Congress for a law with more precise mandates, though such laws can and have been watered down and sometimes avoided. Even if a law passes and is effective, could it be a matter of too little, too late? To say the least, everything I've described drips with pessimism. Small wonder that FCC Commissioner Michael Copps termed the DTV transition as a forthcoming, quote, train wreck, unquote, while his FCC colleague Jonathan Adelstein has termed it a, quote, tsunami, unquote. But it's entirely possible that it could all end up just fine. Everyone could find out in time. Everyone who needs help gets it. And a presumed DTV doomsday, complete with long lines and street riots and looting and other images of unrest, could be averted. But a lot would have to happen before February 18, 2009, to avert this disaster, or a manifold compounding of disasters, of which February 18, 2009 could be just the beginning. For example, deaf communities have petitioned the FCC complaining that, quote, reports of significant technical difficulties with the pass-through and display of closed captioning in DTV are becoming rampant, unquote, according to an August 2007 FCC filing by the Coalition of Organizations for Accessible Technology. Then there's Puerto Rico, where the situation is worse still. More than half of all of Puerto Rican TV viewers use analog over-the-air signals, with fewer options available for accommodations than in the States, according to Puerto Rico's Telecommunications Regulatory Board. Some cynics might say, with the dismal state of television, many people may benefit without their TVs. But despite the ascendancy of the internet as a source of news and information, most Americans still use television and newspapers for their news and information. But with millions, perhaps tens of millions, affected in the wake of a possible fiasco, DTV doomsday and its ongoing aftermath could consign millions of Americans into a media black hole, perhaps abandoned with little additional relief. We could see the digital divide skyrocket and escalate ongoing trends where the U.S. is becoming a third world country and where having a TV set would be a sign that you're part of the privileged classes. Echoes of Hurricane Katrina come to mind. The effective destruction of an American city was bad enough, but a half million displaced persons still sit with little aid and unable to return to the Gulf Coast more than 2 years after the hurricane, as chronicled by the International Tribunal on Hurricanes Katrina and Rita. Poor people in the future might remember the time when they too had TV. If there is a silver lining to the DTV conversion, it is that the potential for awareness and popular involvement on media-related issues could dramatically increase. In recent years, more Americans have entered the media policy arena, and it's been making a difference. Where 3 million people commented to the FCC on its controversial media ownership rewrite in 2003, which successfully overrode an FCC vote, we could be seeing more than 10 times that number possibly enter the arena. Will it be enough? Can it make a difference? The greater the involvement and the earlier people get involved, the better the chances in the end. The essay I just read was published in the website of Flow TV, a journal of critical thinking about television, and that was published online on November 9, 2007. And since that essay was published, a number of developments have since arisen. In fact, on the very day that the essay was published, on November 9th, the following headline from the Associated Press, written by John Dunbar, was published, headline, Digital TV Transition Chief Resigns. Quoting, the Bush administration official who heads the agency charged with ensuring the smooth transition of the television industry to digital broadcasting is leaving that post. John Knoyer was named administrator of the NTIA, the National Telecommunications and Information Administration, in May 2006 by George W. Bush. But Knoyer will resign this month, November 2007, to pursue new opportunities, according to agency spokesman Todd Sedmak. Knoyer's resignation as the president's top telecommunications advisor comes amidst considerable concern on Capitol Hill over the manner in which the government is handling the conversion by television broadcasters from analog to digital. That was from the Associated Press, the headline, Digital TV Transition Chief Resigns. It gets worse still. For example, Multichannel News reported on the very same day, November 9th, in an article written by Todd Spangler, headline, study finds 22% of analog TV owners to, quote, do nothing, unquote, for digital television. Quoting, about 22% of Americans who currently own analog TV sets plan to simply do nothing, unquote, when local broadcast stations are required to stop transmitting analog signals in February 2009, according to a study conducted by the Consumer Electronics Association. CEA Senior Director and Regulatory Counsel Julie Kearney, speaking on a panel at the Future of TV conference, said that the association surveyed consumers with analog TV sets who receive only free over-the-air broadcasts and asked what they plan to do to prepare for the digital TV transition. About 22% said they would subscribe to a cable or satellite service, 33% they would use a government-issued $40 coupon to purchase a digital-to-analog converter box to continue receiving over-the-air broadcast signals, and another 33% plan to purchase a new television set. It gets worse still. In fact, actually, among the very broadcasters who have been complaining about the DTV mandates is, oddly enough, Fox. Headline, just 2 days afterwards, November 11, 2007, headline, Fox stations complain about DTV mandates. Fox Television Stations, a division of Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, is objecting to proposed federal rules that would require the broadcast of public service announcements designed to educate American TV viewers about the impending digital TV transition. Mandating PSAs would not only be bad policy and exceed FCC legal authority, but would also violate the First Amendment because the federal government can't tell TV stations what content to broadcast, according to Fox outside counsel Clark Wadlow in a letter filed at the FCC on November 7th. The DTV public service announcement issue is taken on some urgency because on February 17, 2009, all full-power analog TV stations are by law required to shut down. Many Capitol Hill lawmakers maintain that a public education campaign that includes a healthy dose of PSAs is essential to ensure that millions of consumers are aware of the steps they must take to view TV stations' new digital signals after the analog cutoff. What's really interesting about the article is a quote that they actually quote from Fox regarding Fox's attitude about DTV and its mandates. For example, the FCC, this is Wadlow's writing, that attorney from Fox, said, the FCC would essentially be using its rulemaking authority to compel broadcasters to provide free airtime from the promulgation of a government message, airtime that the government would otherwise have to pay millions of dollars to purchase. FCC Chair Kevin Martin has disclosed that he wants to force TV stations to air DTV transition education PSAs throughout the day, including during evening primetime hours when TV stations tend to maximize their ad revenue and DTV PSA substitutes could do the most financial damage. Now, a very, very interesting aspect about this as far as Fox's attitude, they are pretending like they own the broadcast airwaves and that the government should be paying them in order to broadcast public service announcements, whereas it should be the other way around. Fox is actually allowed free use of the public airwaves and making money off of them. So this attitude should be actually reversed entirely 180 degrees, where if the FCC thinks that they're... No, it's Fox who thinks that they should be letting the public on their airwaves. It's actually... The public is letting Fox use its airwaves, although I don't know how much of the public actually knows that fact. But nonetheless, all of these signs seem to be with these recent developments that even with the dismal picture that I painted in my essay in flowtv.org on that essay about the forthcoming digital TV tsunami, that the it's not just bad, it could be getting worse still. And we'll be keeping up posted on recent and forthcoming developments about that fact in the days and weeks and months to come. That was some accompanying commentary after an essay entitled The Forthcoming DTV Tsunami, published on the website flowtv.org on November 9th, 2007. That concludes this episode of The Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.